Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Gus Van Sant's 1997 film, Good Will Hunting. Our regular co-host, Pat Miller, has been called away. He actually has a second job as a geologist, and there's some sort of emergency excavation going on at Stonehenge, so he was called away to measure the density of the rocks or something. I'm not entirely sure. He'll probably be able to tell us what's going on when he comes back next week. But joining us, as usual, is our trusty co-host, or joining me, I guess, since I'm the only
one here. Yeah, I was about to say.
our trusty co-host, Tyler Brands. Tyler, what's happening?
Ben. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, sir. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
It was good, yeah. Yeah, I killed my own turkey and mashed my own potatoes and, you know, got the jellied cranberries out of my own can. It was a make your own Thanksgiving.
That sounds like the ultra manly way to
Actually, I'm lying. Everything was prepared. I helped out a little bit, but
nice.
I didn't do much, so. How was yours?
It wasn't bad. I mean, it was the first Thanksgiving that I've had outside of my family because I've been out in California and I didn't fly back to Florida. But I got to hang out with Free Reyes, who is better known as Root Mazer from Geek Tyrant, and his wife. And they allowed Pat and I, to come over and kind of crash their family Thanksgiving. So it was pretty cool. You know, much better than just like sitting around eating tacos or something, which is probably what I would have done if I wasn't.
Hell yeah.
You know, so yeah, good stuff. Let's see. We were supposed to have a guest this week. There's the possibility that that person might call in late in the show. So if that happens, then I'll introduce him or her at that point. If not, then we'll just never speak of this again. So, listeners, if you guys are joining us for the first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the show. You can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, it is my turn for the character name game this week, and I've got a pretty good one. The character's name is Johnny Tyler.
Ooh.
Johnny Tyler. So,
Badass name.
Yeah. So we'll be thinking about that, you know, kind of as the show goes on, and then come back to it later on. And keep in mind that that character does have to have some sort of correlation to a film that was released this past Friday.
Are you sure it's not an old radio show?
Johnny Tyler that is not from an old radio show? Is that what you're asking?
No, because there's a character named Johnny Dollar. I was wondering if that was a reference.
No, it's absolutely
but I guess,
not.
I guess not. Okay. All right, never mind.
For my life.
I'll go back to my corner.
Well, since it's just you and I think you should probably come out of your corner. And Let's talk about media consume. What have you been consuming this week?
I know we mentioned this a lot, but I'm just getting started on it. Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was only one episode on demand, like season one, episode one, because it skipped to like season four, but apparently they're releasing, all of season one, like, every couple of days or so, I guess. So I've watched one, two, and three so far, and, it's pretty depressing, you know, getting into it. There's a lot of women bashing, both verbally and physically. So a lot of that makes me kind of uncomfortable because I know I joke around a lot, but I really hope I don't sound like those guys. Other than that, I think Don Draper has like an undeserved sense of like establishment that he thinks he's like the baddest MF-er in New York City. And it's just freaking like, I guess, I don't know. I haven't seen him in the show and I haven't seen Draper's adventures yet. So the fact that he thinks he's like badass in episode one, two, and three kind of makes me think of him as like an anti, like just, you know, he's not somebody I'd look up to, but I'm sure that's going to change through the seasons.
I'm not going to spoil it for you or anything, but it shows that he's definitely capable at his job, and it shows that he's one of the, you know, the kind of brighter minds in the advertising industry. Like if something needs to get done, he finds a way of getting it done. So that's the kind of, I think that's where his confidence lies, is just like his ultimate badassery is that he's actually really good at what he does.
Yeah. The only time I really like him is when he's in like the business environment and not, he's like at home, you know, abusing, you know, just
yeah,
angrily, passive aggressively, you know, hitting at his wife. So it's kind of weird. And then I've been catching up on The Walking Dead, also a very good series by AMC. We had talked briefly about this when we watched The Mist, of how Darabont was going to tackle this issue of zombies versus a select few of people, and we kind of predicted that he might just kind of slough off the whole zombie thing and focus more on the people and their reactions to the situation. And for the most part, it is exactly that, but he's doing a way better job than what we may have seen in The Mist. So
yeah, absolutely.
I've seen 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to check out 4 and 5 in the next couple of days. But yeah, so far, I mean, there's been plenty of zombiness, but it's not so much so that it's only zombies. I mean, it's a lot of character base and you know, stuff going on at the camp and stuff going on in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I've never read the graphic novel, but I thought for sure that it was him alone for a really long part of the time.
Oh, okay.
So I thought it was going to be him and just him and his wanderings through these cities. So I didn't know if he would be like talking to himself or, but it's not like that at all. Like, he meets up with people every episode. And so there's always, and there's no like, you know, overdubbed narrative or anything,
right?
Which is nice. So
I wonder, I don't remember if we've actually talked about this specific topic on the show before, but what did you think about episode 2? Because that one is the one. And spoiler alert for the second episode of Walking Dead, but it's very brief. I mean, the episode is called Guts, so you kind of get an idea of what's going to happen. They essentially, a lot of the characters just like cut this dead person open and kind of wipe guts all over them and are able to kind of blend in with the zombies out in the world because of the sense of smell that comes from the innards of a human being, you know? And Pat and I were talking about this, and again, like I said, I don't remember, so forgive me if we've actually spoken about this specific thing, but doing something so bold like that in a second episode of a show is pretty freaking ballsy on AMC's part, right?
You mean the actual cutting open of the person?
Like, just that kind of subject matter, like, to that gruesome degree on in a show, where I feel like that's one of the reasons that I kind of like AMC, is because they have the ability to do something like that, and they just don't care if it, like, offends people, or they know, like, what kind of audience they're going for.
Right.
They know that those people are going to continue to watch the show, and they're essentially warning other people who aren't really down for it by just showing a crap ton of blood and gore and stuff in the second episode of the season, and just being like, hey, if you can't hang with this, then go watch something else.
Yeah. That's a good point. I like that. But I did like how they're coming to, like, I always put myself in the same situation, or I try to put myself in the same situation, and I think, what would I do? And, you know, the first thing that comes to my head is like, well, why don't you just kind of walk real slow like the zombies, and you can kind of blend in and get away. But they made up the thing where they have a heightened sense of smell, like they can smell that you're not dead.
Right.
And so that whole idea of like cutting open something and putting it all in your body is like kind of it's kind of a clever way of doing it. But something that they did so soon that it wasn't like, oh, why haven't you thought of this yet? Or, you know, you could have done this the whole time that you're doing it now, but they did it right away. So you're like, okay, well, they're thinking of everything.
Yeah.
Just like a normal person would.
Mm-hmm.
I especially like the some of those people they're hanging out with really make me mad, but I'm glad a lot of them get their comeuppance. Like the one guy at the top of the building, and then the guy in episode 3 that just gets his ass handed to him at the side of the lake.
Yeah.
I was just like, But there are some other issues with the cop coming back and his quote-unquote friend and that kind of dealings that I want to talk about, but I don't – that would be a pretty big spoiler as far as people. So check out The Walking Dead. It's all – it's on demand here.
Yeah.
All 4 episodes. So check your local cable companies. And by here, I mean Florida, California.
Okay.
California, I don't know. They have Turner Cable, whatever you have out there.
We have Time Warner. I'm not entirely sure if it's available on demand here or not. But
yeah, but I'll try to check it out. I know I had a hard time finding it online.
Yeah.
Finally, I've been reading this new Indiana Jones novel. It's Indiana Jones and the Army of the Dead, also having to do with zombies. Well, I haven't gotten to that part yet, but it take this scenario in 1944, and he's in the Secret Service, but he's playing like he's on the British side and he's on the American side. Indiana Jones,
okay,
is who I'm talking about, and that guy McHale, the guy, the British guy that he kind of teams up with in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Oh yes,
he's like a sidekick in this one.
Okay,
and there's like Japanese German agents. And so far, it's written kind of, it's written well. It's written by Steve Perry, not the Journey frontman, but right. The author Steve Perry, who whose famous science fiction works are Star Wars: Shadows of the Empire and Star Wars. I think he wrote an entire book on the Death Star. So kudos to him.
Right.
But he's writing it. The pace of the book is really good. But Indiana Jones says a lot of things that you wouldn't think he'd say in the movie.
Okay.
But then I think, well, you can't really, because he's very quiet in the movies. He's kind of stern, and he talks with his, he talks very softly, but he knows what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
In this, he like makes comments about everything, like he's kind of a joking character. But I guess it's hard to translate a movie character into a book. So I guess Perry has taken a few pages out of his own book to try to shape the character, which is cool, I guess.
Okay,
but. Army of the Dead, it's not more than like 300 pages, so I mean, if you're looking for a quick read,
yeah,
it's the newest one out there. I think a lot of Indiana Jones books are old, but this is like the one that came out.
Does it kind of still feel like Indiana Jones though?
So far, yes.
Okay,
I have to get into the meat of the story first, but I just wanted to, you know, this might be a recurring segment in my media consumed where I can be like, oh yeah, Army of the Dead, sucking balls, and then I'll come back the next week and be like, all right, it's redeemed itself. So this is just the first, I've read the first couple of chapters, and so far it's off to a good start. So
cool. Well, yeah, as far as what I've been watching, I've actually been catching up with Dexter. The fifth season of Dexter is currently airing on Showtime right now. Have you ever watched any of this show, Tyler?
I watched the end of like episode 3
of like a random season or what?
Season 1 episode 3, like the last 10 minutes.
Wow, okay.
Dumps a body into his car, and then I was like, okay.
Gotcha. I'm a really big fan of this show. I think the first season is the best because there's a lot of kind of twists and stuff through the story that you don't really see coming. I should probably say, for people who don't know what Dexter is, it's about a character named Dexter Morgan, who's played by Michael C. Hall really, really well, actually. Like, he's probably one of the better actors playing a consistent character on TV these days. And it's set in Miami, and Dexter is a blood spatter analyst for the Miami Police Department, but he's also a serial killer. So he kills people. The only people that he kills are other serial killers, basically. So he's kind of ostensibly a good guy, even though he commits these murders. But everybody that he kills, you know, are people that quote unquote deserve to be killed. So there's a lot of kind of morality issues and stuff that the show deals with really well. It's got kind of a noir feel. There's a lot of narrative and voiceover and stuff like that going on. And the relationships between the characters and his family is involved and things like that. It's just a really, really well-done show. The first season I thought was the best, and it's slowly been kind of decreasing from there. I feel like every season has been trying to recapture the formula of the first season to varying degrees of success. Probably the closest that it's come is the fourth season, which actually starred John Lithgow in like a season-long guest starring capacity or whatever, and that was a really good season too. Season as well, not to be confused with the real season two. And then season five, I think, has gotten a lot better than anything that they've done since season one. So I'm really, really like full-on back into the show during season five. Julia Stiles is the guest on this season, and things happen throughout the course of the first four seasons that allow the story to be opened up in a way that was impossible up until this point. And now that those things are out of the way and these opportunities are presented to the character, I feel like they have a lot more room to go in different directions with the show and kind of get back to the basics and what made season one so great. So I think I'm on like episode 7, and there's the 10th episode of the season is airing tonight. So, you know, I'm a few back, but if you guys, I would recommend definitely, if you've never heard of the show or haven't watched it or anything, definitely check out the first season on DVD. It's kind of gruesome at certain points, but it's so well done. And if you like just really kind of high quality, well-made TV, I think that's a good spot to go. Don't set your expectations too high for the rest of the series. Although, like I said, season 5 is getting really great. So, that's a lot of what I've been watching.
I thought you were talking about Mike and Molly for a second there, as far as the best in television right now, but yeah. Is that found on Showtime or Cinemax or something?
Dexter is on Showtime. Mike and Molly is on CBS.
Okay, CBS. Okay, let me write that down.
Yeah. A couple things that I've been watching. I have tried and been thwarted twice now to see Black Swan, which is the new Darren Aronofsky movie starring Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis. And due to various reasons, I haven't been able to see it. But I believe I'm going to get a chance to check it out this coming week. And in kind of preparation for that, I've been watching a couple ballet movies that are, you know, it sounds really bizarre, but I wanted to kind of see what these things were that had a little bit of inspiration into Black Swan, just to kind of get myself into that mindset. So there's this movie from 1948 called The Red Shoes, and it was directed and written and produced by these guys named Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. And it's a British movie. It's kind of based on the fairy tale, The Red Shoes, by Hans Christian Andersen. And I don't know. I mean, if you're really into old movie, like, you know, things like this, movies that are this old tend to really put a divide in our generation, Tyler. I feel like people are really either willing to go back and watch movies like that and kind of do so with an open mind, or just totally closed off to it and refuse to watch anything post-1980. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. I meet those people all the time, and I kind of have trouble talking about movies with them.
Yeah,
when they don't watch anything past 2000.
Right, right.
Does it have Vin Diesel in it? I'm not watching it.
So I think if you're willing to kind of give an older movie like that a shot, it's in color even. You don't even have to worry about freaking black or white if that is one of those things that turns you off for some reason. It's really kind of interesting, and I would recommend checking it out before Black Swan, just because I did the same thing, and I feel like it'll be kind of good. There's some of the stuff like makeup wise and like visually and stuff that I've already seen replicated in Black Swan just from the trailers and stuff. So The Red Shoes is one of the ones that Martin Scorsese has named like one of his all-time favorite movies. He did this big restoration project of it, and it took like I think 5 or 6 years or something to fully restore the movie, and they just put it out, you know, on Blu-ray or whatever in June of 2009. So he's been kind of one of the proponents of trying to get this movie seen by a larger audience and stuff, because I don't think it was very well received when it actually came out. But anyway, I don't know. You know, it's just one of those things where if you're interested in kind of psychological ballet movies, then check out The Red Shoes. I also watched Suspiria for the first time, which is Dario Argento's 1977 Italian kind of psychological horror movie, again, about a ballet dancer who goes to this school. And this one, the plot is a little bit more well-known, so this isn't necessarily a spoiler, because it'll probably say it in the plot synopsis if you read it anywhere. But this girl goes to this school, this ballet school, and discovers that it's run by, like, a coven of witches. So, for some reason, it's been listed as, like, you know, one of the 50, 20 scariest movies of all time or whatever on all these kinds of lists and stuff that were coming out back during the kind of best of the decade lists and all those things, like the best, you know, basically in all these movie lists, it's up there as one of the scariest movies ever made. So I was checking it out, and it's not as scary as you might imagine, but it's definitely really weird. And I don't know if it was just the Netflix version that I watched, or if it was specifically designed in the sound design of the movie, but the music is jacked up really, really loud, and the dialogue is so quiet that you're constantly trying to shuffle back and forth between volumes, figuring out what's going on. And it was so bad at one point, I'm like, okay, this has to be intentional. I don't think that anybody could actually watch this and not realize it and then go ahead and release it to a wide audience. But I don't know, it could have been just some sort of Netflix issue. But in any case, if you're going to pick between Suspiria and The Red Shoes, I would recommend The Red Shoes, even though Suspiria is a lot more recent and probably a lot more well-known. I just something about it just kind of turned me off. I wasn't necessarily a big fan of that one. The Red Shoes, I can see how that is a little bit more influential just because also it's older, but it's, you know, it's kind of well acted. Suspiria, because of the conditions under which it was made, it's not very well acted, and it's, I don't know, there's a lot of cool, interesting lighting stuff going on in there, but if that's the best thing you can say about a movie, then you're probably better off watching something else.
Yeah.
So,
it had good lighting, though.
Yeah.
Are you going to check out Billy Elliot?
No, I'm not, actually. I was not planning on going through and watching, like, every ballet movie ever made. I think those
the first one that jumped into my mind when you said ballet movie is like, oh god, he watched Billy Elliot.
No, I think Red Shoes and Suspiria were both that were kind of mentioned as influences of Black Swan, so that's why I just wanted to kind of check those out and kind of get myself into that mindset before I actually saw the movie. So,
10-4.
All right, so let's go ahead and talk about Good Will Hunting. But before we do that, let me introduce our guest. We just got a Skype call from our guest, Vince Mancini, the head writer and co-founder of FilmDrunk.com. Vince, thanks for coming back and joining us on the Not Just New Movies podcast.
Not a problem.
On the campus of one of America's leading universities.
There is a problem on the main hallway chalkboard. It took my colleagues and I more than 2 years to prove it. I'm hoping that one of you might prove it by the end of the semester.
The most gifted mind to ever enter its classrooms.
This is great. We did this.
Is the person who cleans its floors.
I just need the name of this guy who works in my building.
Got this job through his PO, you can call him.
PO?
Parole officer.
Meet Will Hunting.
I've been looking over this rap sheet of yours. Assault, theft, resisting.
I've spoken to the judge, and he's agreed to release you under my supervision.
Really?
But you have to meet with a therapist every week.
That's pretty good!
For the first time in his life, he's about to meet his match.
How many shrinks you go to before me?
5. This boy's genius is unparalleled. I need someone who can get through to him.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin. I went on a date last week.
Going out again?
No. This girl's like, you know, beautiful. She's smart. She's fun. She's like perfect right now. I don't want to ruin that.
Maybe you're perfect right now. Maybe you don't want to ruin that.
Have you talked to him at all about his future?
Give him time to figure out what he wants.
This boy has that gift. Can you imagine if Einstein would have given that up just to get drunk with his buddies every night?
Good to have you, sir. All right, so Good Will Hunting. Let's talk about this. 1997, directed by Gus Van Sant and written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Tyler, let's start with you. What did you think just about – had you seen Good Will Hunting before, and what did you think about the movie?
I have not seen Good Will Hunting, but I have today. I watched it today.
Right.
Fear not. I've seen the movie. Yeah, I thought it was a pretty dramatic film. You know, not something I'd you know, make myself, but again, I'm not a movie maker, so whatever. The Boston accent was pretty entertaining, as most fake Boston accents go.
You call an Affleck's accent fake, you queer?
Oh, I was waiting to see who would break the bubble, so I might just finish this review in a fake Boston accent. But no, I really enjoyed Robin Williams' character and the British guy that played the other professor. I thought the dynamics between them was pretty interesting. You know, Damon's character was a dumbass, but I'm sure we'll talk about that. But overall, the film was very, very good. I'll tell you, better than the Bo Sox.
Vince, well, what did you think about Good Will Hunting?
I mean, not to sound queer, nothing, but I thought it's a good. No, it's a good movie. It's just like I didn't watch it again. I saw it about a month ago on cable, so it's not like super, super fresh in my mind, but. Huh. I just remember watching it and, like, I forget how sort of contrived it is. I think dramatic is a really good word. It's, like, super, super like contrived drama. It kind of reminds me of like The Social Network or you know, The Town to some extent, where it's like, I feel like it's a good movie, but it's very much a movie, you know?
Yeah. I think the comparison to the Social Network is something that I've never really thought of before, but it does have that kind of overarching, just this kind of like weight hanging above it that does feel very much like a written thing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the dialogue, like, alone, you could tell was, you know, pre-written, just the way they talked and like the intense conversations they would have, it seemed all really scripted.
Yeah
and the whole like, there's so many, especially the Town comparison. I think the main thing that reminded me of that is just like, there's so many parts where the characters have like this big monologue, and it's fun to watch. It's definitely not how real people talk at all. It's just like, you know, it's like long, clever chunks of like that entire scene where he's like, maybe I just kill my buddy, take his job, fuck his friend, and burn my house down, you know? And it's like, I forget what exactly he says during that whole, but I mean, that one monologue goes on for so long.
Yeah.
It's fun, but you're like, there's, you know, there's no way a real person would ever talk like this.
Right, and I think that's probably due to the fact that Damon and Affleck were both young. They wrote this movie essentially for themselves to kind of launch their career. So, you know, as any young actor would want to do, you give yourself something good to say. And there's a couple scenes in this movie where Matt Damon just goes off on people. He just like verbally eviscerates this guy in this Harvard bar that they go to, and like the guy, you know, Affleck's trying to hit on Minnie Driver and her friend, and like this guy strolls up and like, you know, he's got like this like douche hair and this ponytail, and he comes up and tries to like essentially cock block Ben Affleck, and then Damon steps in and just goes off on him about how he's just like regurgitating books that he's read, and because Damon has this whatever eidetic memory or whatever, that photographic memory where he can, you know, just remember things, he has read the same books that this douchebag has read and just like quotes him before he can finish quoting, you know, these books or whatever, and just goes off on like, yeah, like this 2-minute rant where it's just, he just leaves the guy broken and walking away with his head between his legs.
Have you seen the It's Always Sunny episode where they go back to college and Charlie keeps quoting that scene?
Yeah.
Oh, I bet you've been reading a lot of that God in S. Wood, huh?
Yeah, I love It's Always Sunny. It's such a great show.
I like when I guess we don't want to talk about Always Sunny, but when Charlie regurgitates law at the lawyer's office is always cracking me up as well.
Yeah.
I really like as much as Matt Damon was like the tough guy for most of the scene, I really enjoyed how he would get shoved to the ground by Williams with he would like fight back with his own monologue when they're sitting on the park bench. And
yeah,
it's just like, have you ever laid with a woman who you just wanted to love for the rest of your life? And has she ever died in your arms? No, you're just a fucking kid.
Yeah.
I really like those scenes because, you know, when he was choke slamming him against the wall, I thought that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, he definitely, I mean, there's, I don't know, this movie, I like it to some degree just because I feel like it's well made and it's, you know, relatively well written for a movie that, as we've said, feels very quote unquote written. But there's something about it too that kind of turns me off, in that it's about a bunch of people sitting around talking about their feelings and stuff. And it's just, it's one of those things that like, you know, you step back and look at movies that like Bogart and John Wayne made, and they never would have done something like this. You know, like there's an element of manliness that's completely gone from a movie like this that's about, and you know, you could talk about how that's the basis of psychology and whether or not that's like the legitimacy of that as a profession or whatever. But just something about this movie where they're just sitting in this office talking about, you know, their backgrounds and stuff. I don't know. What did you guys think about that?
I feel like it's very much of the like therapy generation. I mean, Robin Williams' whole character is kind of silly to me, where he's like, oh, it's the haunted guy with the dead wife and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's very much of the pop psychology 90s sort of let's all share sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you could just tell they were trying to write a script that would win awards. You know, it just had every actor was working on, you know, full scale. Like, you know, Minnie Driver was at her, at her best. You know, all the actors were pulling their own weight, which is good when you see a movie full of different characters and each character kind of pulls their own weight. And you could just tell, it's like, oh, when they were making this movie, they knew they were going to try to get some Academy Awards or Gold Globes or whatever they were trying to get with just the drama and the, like you said, like the psychology and the feelings of every person in the act or in the play or in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because this is the movie that Robin Williams actually won his first Oscar with. Like, he won Best Supporting Actor. And Affleck and Damon obviously won like the best original screenplay or whatever. And I actually went back and watched like the YouTube videos of them accepting the award and stuff. And they're so young. Like, I think Affleck was 25 at the time. And, you know, I'm 25 right now. Just imagining doing something like that is kind of mind blowing. Like, as hackneyed and whatever as some of this, the movie comes across, like, it's still a pretty impressive accomplishment.
Well, it's like, if you're a young struggling actor, like, what do you have to do? Oh, just, you know, write Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you're set.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of that's why Affleck and Damon are still, you know, kind of considered Hollywood's golden boys, is just because of their kind of meteoric rise based on this movie where they kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, they were doing some things here and there with Kevin Smith, some of his early movies. Ben Affleck was in Mallrats, and then they both were working on Dogma, I think, at the time. And yeah, but I mean, obviously, they both have kind of taken off since then. But, you know, something I was reading about this that I had no idea, I don't know if you guys knew this, but it says that, I'm reading on from Wikipedia here, and it says that the movie was originally written as a thriller, like where Will Hunting was being targeted by the FBI to become like an agent or whatever, and it was kind of like on the run type of thing. And then the studio essentially talked them out of those thriller aspects and wanted them to kind of pare it down and just focus more on the relationship between Robin Williams and Matt Damon.
Well, it was funny, while I was watching the film, I was like, you know, those people are always recutting movies to make fake trailers. We could have definitely, you know, sat down and recut this film to do like a Bourne prequel before the Bourne Identity, before he becomes an agent. We could take that scene where he's in the interview for the NSA and be like, do you really want to join the NSA? And then we could just have all this, we could take scenes from like the Green Zone or something. Yeah. And make a fake trailer or something.
Yeah. There's a lot of, and like the Good Shepherd and stuff. Matt Damon has definitely gotten into that kind of, those kinds of movies fairly often in his career. But
yeah, I think it would work too. You should do it, Ben.
Oh, The Good Shepherd, like the least edited movie ever.
I've never seen it. I heard it was really long, though.
It would, like, you're waiting for something to happen, and it's like nothing happens. And then finally, at like the very, very end, like all the, like, you're wondering what the hell you're waiting for. And then at the end, you realize what you're waiting for, but you're like, God damn, I was so bored for like the last 40 minutes.
Good Shepherd flashes across the screen. You've been screwed.
Well, I don't know. There's a couple weird things that happen in this movie. Do you guys, I don't know, Vince, because it's been a little bit since you've seen it. Do you remember the fight, like the slow motion fight on the basketball court? Do you remember that scene?
I do. That was so, yeah, it was really weirdly filmed.
Yeah, and it was like handheld. They were kind of like up in their faces. And the thing that freaked me out was that Jerry Rafferty, like Baker Street or something, was playing in the background. The song that has no business being in a fight scene. Like, it barely has enough business being on like a light radio, adult contemporary radio station or something. I have no idea like what their musical choices were, like what they were thinking when they made this. Tyler, did you see, I mean, did that scene strike you as odd at all?
Well, especially because Matt Damon came and beat this kid's ass because he beat him up in kindergarten. So now I'm going to have to be looking over my shoulder everywhere I go, hoping that someone from, you know, 15 years ago isn't gunning for me.
Well, if it's but Matt yeah, I Damon, thought it was... I think you're pretty safe.
I thought, was he like 5'4" or something? Real, isn't he real short?
I don't know. I don't think he's that short. He just not. I don't know. He doesn't strike me as a guy that, you know. He doesn't strike me as the neighborhood tough.
Remember kindergarten?
I thought you were implying Vince, I thought you were implying that if Matt Damon beat him up, then he could just sue him and walk away with a lot of money and never work again. But
well, that's true also.
Well, the slow-mo though, you could tell they were filming it in slow-mo. Like they weren't filming a real fight scene because you could tell like the fist didn't really have impact on the other person's face, and you're just like, that's not how you I guess they're doing it in slow-mo. Maybe because they're inexperienced in filmmaking, they're like, we can't afford choreographers or possible fight experts, so we're just going to slow-mo this shit.
Well, the thing about it is, like, I could see if they did something like that if Damon and Affleck were kind of co-directing it, but Gus Van Sant was directing it. Like, he should know what looks good on a screen and what doesn't.
It seems like it's probably the precursor to all his weird, like, arty movies where he, like, wanted to crowbar that into this really super Hollywood sort of thing. It's like, no, I'm going to do this really impressionistic fight scene, don't worry about it.
Yeah. And maybe he's friends with Jerry Rafferty and that's why the music was going on. That's the only explanation I can think of. But
yeah, we'll put you into the fight scene.
I'm trying to think about, like, is there anything else that you guys kind of wanted to talk about that, you know, just kind of comes to mind when speaking about this movie?
I kind of feel like it's one of those movies where there's so many like stock plot twists and stock characters, but at the same time it's so well done it sort of explains why those things are stock Hollywood, you know, dramatic staples. It's like, oh, you realize, you know, it's really pleasing to watch that sort of thing. Like, you understand how those become cliches from watching Good Will Hunting, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's kind of amazing how much this movie has really ingrained itself in popular culture. I mean, we're talking about It's Always Sunny. Like, that's one of probably 50 or 60 things that have referenced Good Will Hunting since it came out, and it really didn't come out that long ago, you know, so it's just been like 13 years. So I feel like everybody, you know, you write something on a chalkboard in a movie or a TV show or something, and you kind of automatically think of Good Will Hunting.
That was another thing I totally forgot about with the Social Network, is as soon as the Social Network trailer came out, I was like, really? He's going to write the fucking equations on the window? Really? Like, isn't that... And at the time, I was like, isn't this a little Beautiful Mind? And then I realized, oh, no, it came way before that. Probably even before Good Will Hunting, but yeah.
Yeah,
I thought Beautiful Mind as well. And every time I see equations and the character phasing in and out of the equations as they slowly move across the screen, I always think Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to shake that. I thought the Minnie Driver, Matt Damon relationship was adequately put in. Like, I didn't think they overdid it, and I didn't think they underdid it. I think that was kind of, it worked in well with the rest of the drama between his personal self and his relationship with Ben Affleck and Robin Williams. You know, he had so many of these new interactions, like in a span of, I don't even know how long, like 2 months. You know, one day he's just a smart-ass kid, and then all of a sudden he's being like pampered by women, professors, the NSA. So I thought as far as that aspect, it was adequate, I guess.
I forgot how nice her boobs looked back then.
Well, aside from that, Vince, what did you think about Minnie? What did you think about Minnie Driver in the movie, just like performance wise and stuff?
I don't know. I mean, she didn't really like strike me that much one way or the other. I thought it was kind of character was interesting. I don't know. She was like, there's a lot going on with that character, which was nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't like your standard, you know, they made her British and shit. I don't know. She had a lot of story with her, but I don't know. She didn't really strike me one way or the other where I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Or she worked as a character, I thought, pretty much.
Yeah. I found her to be very tolerable, which is better than many of her other performances, I think. So
I like her when she's snarky and smartass like that. In Gross Point Blank with John Cusack, she doesn't have a British accent. I guess she fakes an American one, but she kind of plays the same like smartass character where she's, you know, she knows how to speak well and like, you know, talk around people. It's just in this movie she just happens to have a British accent. So, and I liked her in Gross Point Blank. So I just obviously
she's carried over. Much more memorable to me in Gross Point. Well, pretty much Gross Point Blank's much more memorable than Good Will Hunting in general. Yeah. But yeah, her character is definitely more memorable than that.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about is this kind of concept of Boston exploitation. And Vince, I know that you've, you know, I listened to your the Fratcast review of The Town, leaving
it. Put it in your rear view, did you?
Yeah. And this is something that you guys mentioned about, you know, especially Ben Affleck recently with Gone Baby Gone and with The Town, you know, kind of becoming borderline obsessed with like these Boston set things. And like The Town, I think, is a little bit more almost cartoonish in the way that it exploits Boston. But Good Will Hunting definitely has some of that in there. And I think it's probably just, I don't know, what do you think how do you think that plays up, you know, kind of in comparison maybe to some of the Affleck's later stuff, or just like why they decided to do something that was so heavily set in the Boston area?
I feel like Good Will Hunting sort of like the honest where, you know, they sort of had a feel for growing up there and they wanted to include elements of that in the movie. And then by the time The Town came out, I feel like that was like a conscious Boston exploitation where, you know, they weren't trying to make it an honest Boston. They're just sort of trying to like make an entertaining, like, you know, like the way that Sopranos is or something, you know, it's just like they're taking it to a fictional level, but they're conscious of it, and they're doing it because it's fun, basically, and because Boston exploitation has become like a thing since the, you know, the late 90s, where it was just starting out, and now it's like everybody's sort of used to it, and so they just, you know, they kind of wanted to go for it.
Like, yeah.
Oh, you know, what's the most Boston thing we can think of? Oh, they're gonna rob Fenway Park. You know?
Go Sox.
Yeah, you're gonna rob.
We need Jimmy Fallon. Well, I it's kind of interesting now thinking about this. Like, you know, you see the success of The Departed and the huge, you know, build up to Shutter Island, both kind of Boston exploitation, well, however you, hell you say that word, Boston exploitation. But then I think, you know, they came from like Kevin Smith's corner, where Kevin Smith, all of his movies kind of have to deal with New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
In one way or another. And so maybe they just said, oh, well, we'll just make all our movies from Boston. So, you know, we'll have the same success as Kevin Smith or something. You know, maybe that was their line of thought when they were, or Ben Affleck's line of thought when he's, you know, writing his scripts.
Yeah.
He's like, for God's sakes, I was in Jersey, girl.
Yeah, there's, you know, I haven't really been a fan of Family Guy for a while, but there is one thing that they did pretty well, which is like one of their random flashbacks is they cut away to the writer's room and Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are hanging out, and like Damon just finishes writing Good Will Hunting, and Affleck is laying on the couch. It's like, hey, would you mind if I threw my name on that too? And he's like, why? You've done nothing but like eat and smoke pot for the last 6 months. So
and then he farts.
Yeah, there's this concept of Damon, especially in Hollywood now, being kind of more respected than Ben Affleck. But I feel like Affleck as a director and maybe even as a co-writer is kind of slowly gaining traction on that again.
I feel like, yeah, when it came out, everybody thought that Damon probably did everything. But now, having looked at like their careers, I feel like, I don't know, I wonder if Affleck was the creative driving force the whole time, just because I haven't really seen Damon direct many movies since. Has he directed anything?
Don't think he has. No, I don't think he's directed anything.
And Affleck's directed a few that have been really good. And I don't know. I definitely think Damon's like the better actor, but
yeah,
from a creative standpoint, I feel like, you know, having not seen anything that Affleck's done, I mean that Damon's done, that Affleck seems to have the better career there.
Yeah, and it's weird that Ben Affleck's kind of track record too of, you know, going from something like this to, you know, the Kevin Smith stuff, and then like what's it called? There's the website called Deadline just ran this kind of Q&A with Ben Affleck that I was reading the other day, and it, you know, made mention of like charting his kind of rise and fall as an actor, you know, going up into these big blockbusters like Armageddon and Pearl Harbor and all this stuff, and then kind of dropping off with the whole Jennifer Lopez thing and becoming this kind of tabloid thing, and then the kind of rewriting his own career resurgence with Gone Baby Gone. But what did you guys think about Ben Affleck as an actor in Good Will Hunting?
I thought his blow-dried hair was pretty hilarious.
I don't know. He just played, you know, an integral part, but You know, he had the Boston accent down. That was the only entertaining part I found of his performance.
Yeah.
The fact that the big speech at the end with whether the cement yard or wherever the hell they are, the cinder block graveyard, where he talks about, you know, walking up to the house and, you know, hoping he's not there. I think that was kind of, like you're saying, every character has had its chance to shine. And, you know, Matt Damon wrote in the part where he tells off the university douchebag. I think that was like Ben Affleck's, you know, time to shine as far as like the emotional speech or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was, I thought maybe that if that wasn't in the movie, I don't think I would have missed it or called that should have been in there, but you know, whatever.
Well, I think that's one of those things that Vince was talking about where it's just kind of a feel good moment and you realize why something like that becomes cliche is because, you know, you hear something like that, and then when the movie ends and there is that final scene where he walks up and realizes that Will has just packed up and left, and he's got this kind of half smirk on his face. Like, there's something about that that's satisfying, you know? Like, you feel like Will is going to maybe live up to his potential, or if not, you know, mathematically or whatever, like, career-wise, at least he's doing something for himself. So, like, there's this satisfaction that happens in that moment that I think, you know, Vince touched on a little while ago.
I just like how the friend is so excited he gets to sit in the front seat finally.
Yeah, Casey Affleck. That was it's kind of interesting to watch Casey Affleck in such a young as such a young actor there. Because
talking about me, prick.
It's taken him so long to break. Like, you remember he was in Good Will Hunting, and then he was just in nothing, it seems like, until Assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah, and he was even in like the Ocean's 11 movies, but and even, like, Scott Conn, both were like people that I barely even recognized. Like, they were the kind of bickering brothers, if I recall correctly, in those movies. And, you know, they were the non big name actors in, you know, of a list of massive, you know, huge Hollywood stars. So I didn't even really know who they were even in that movie. And then it really was the Assassination of Jesse James that kind of launched because Jesse James and Gone Baby Gone came out in 2007, came out in the same year. So it was like a huge year for Casey Affleck. And now he's kind of he's at least on people's radars as opposed to, you know, 10 years before doing a Good Will Hunting where it's like
he was basically like Frank Stallone.
Yeah.
Did you guys see his documentary, the Joaquin Phoenix documentary?
No, I did not get a chance to see that yet.
Well, I won't spoil it for you.
Well, I know the kind of story behind it, and that they came out and said basically that the whole thing was just a performance. But
what would you call it, Vince? Joaquin Hard or something?
Yeah, walk hard, but with a J.
Yeah, walk hard. Yeah.
It was like, I mean, if they'd done it like Borat and like had, like, Joaquin Phoenix is kind of an amazing actor. You as you watch it, you're like, wow. I mean, amazing in the way that like Sacha Baron Cohen is, where you can maintain character in like these crazy situations and just come up with stuff off the top of his head that is like so freaking brilliant.
Yeah.
But then like they didn't really know where they wanted to go with the movie. So the rest of it is just like this total, it's like that mixed with just this total pretentious wank where like there's nothing going on. They couldn't really decide what they wanted to make, so they just like made this really stupid, like, open narrative pretentious thing. Like, the last scene is like 5 friggin' minutes of Joaquin Phoenix like walking through the stream, and it's just so boring because there's nothing going on, and you can just tell that there wasn't like a, they never decided what they wanted the movie to be, so they just kind of threw everything at the wall, and they're like, oh, well, here you go.
Walking through a stream? Just like...
Yeah. And it was so boneheaded, because the film begins with Joaquin Phoenix, like, in the playing in this stream, like, in this waterfall with his family or whatever. You know, when he's a little kid, it's like a old home movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they end the movie, like, at the same waterfall, and it's supposed to be, like, it's supposed to be meaningful, but it's so not meaningful after you've just watched Joaquin Phoenix like shit, like get shit on by his friend, literally. And it's like, all right, if you want to make a poop joke movie, like do it. You guys are pretty good at that, but don't try to sell us this this whole like artsy documentary about, you know, media and media coverage. It's like, well, you you did definitely, you invented the, you played a practical joke and then you're going to act like it's some critique. I mean, you were creating most of these headlines. I don't know.
Yeah.
Lock hard.
I'm glad that they finally, you know, came out and admitted that that was an actual performance, because I don't know how many, I was kind of sick of the whole debate of whether or not that was real or not.
Yeah, I read the Ebert article afterwards where he's like, I was one of the few, I mean, I love Ebert, but he's like, I was one of the few people that actually wondered, you know, when none of us, when we all thought it was real, I was one of the few that actually wondered, worried for his sanity and worried for Joaquin Phoenix's well-being and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, that's just because your generation is not media savvy to understand, like, instantly that was performance art. Like, people our age, like, we watch it, and it's like, it's completely obvious. Like, there's never any question. There was never any question that was a put-on for us. And so it's like, well, of course we're not going to wonder, because it's clearly a practical joke. I just was reminded of that because my dad was here over Thanksgiving, and I see him like going through his email forwards that people his age send around, and he'll play these videos. And to us, it's like, all right, well, that's clearly not real. And they have like these Photoshop forwards and all that. And it's such a generational thing, which is funny. Like people older than we are, like, really do not get the, you know, they don't understand that people just make this crap up.
Yeah, and like the ease of the internet. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've seen things on, you know, on email threads of like a shark eating a helicopter out of the water.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like people send that around and they're like, holy crap. And if you're under the age of 30, you know that's like not legit at all.
I feel like that's like half of the Tea Party base is just retarded email forwards.
We've cracked the code.
I'm serious.
Yeah, I think most of us can go back to the original photo of that shark. Like, it's out in the middle of nowhere, and we know exactly how to Photoshop it into anything. Have, like, someone throwing a baby off a building and that shark eating it. And we'll just be like, email that around, see how many hits it gets.
Yeah, we should try something like that just to see. I'm trying to see if there's any way that we could bring this back to Good Will Hunting, but I feel like we've covered a lot of it. There's not much
more. I feel like it's similar to the... It's one of those movies where we see it and we recognize that it's very, very much like a movie, you know? And I feel like it's one of those things where I feel like Oprah or someone would just be gushing about how would take the gritty realism at face value and not for like the comedic value.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's the scene where like in their first therapy session or whatever, where Robin Williams is in the office and Matt Damon comes in, and Matt Damon essentially, you know, quote unquote, reads Robin Williams based on this painting that he's got of like a guy sitting in a boat with a storm and stuff. Like, all of it is just so kind of on the nose, I think.
Yeah. And just his whole character where he's like, he's the, what is Edward James Olmos in Stand and Deliver? Like, whatever his character's name is. He's like that character of psychologist. Like, I'm going to reach this kid.
Yeah. Yeah, like that just reminds me of Cartman from that South Park episode. He becomes the teacher.
I have to reach these kids. Yeah, we should have a movie marathon of all those teachers influencing the inner city students marathon.
Oh man, that would take forever. There's so many of those.
Dangerous Minds. Oh yeah.
Yeah, the Substitute 1 through 5.
Kindergarten Cop.
Oh God, have you seen Jingle All the Way?
It's funny.
Blu-ray, Vince.
It's funny because Tyler and I actually, we used to live together, and this was about, what, last year, Tyler, right? Or was it 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago, it was around Christmas time, and, you know, Conan O'Brien was in his full swing where he would just kind of be referencing Jingle All the Way all the time, you know, calling it this kind of holiday classic, and he would be doing his Arnold Schwarzenegger impression and stuff. And I hadn't seen the movie in a long time, so we decided to get it on Blu-ray and watch it. But, Vince, I know that you, you know, follow you on Twitter or whatever, and saw that you recently watched it. But what did you think about Jingle All the Way?
I was just amazed. I mean, I knew it was bad, like, from a story standpoint, but I didn't realize how just badly made it was, like, in every department. I mean, it just looks like they shot it in, like, 10 days, you know, yes. Where that, like, every single scene is just, it's almost like surveillance camera. Like, everything's just like a medium shot where, like, they don't want to set two cameras up. So it's just like, there's no medium shot. Like, there's something happens and it's all in one medium shot. And then they cut to, like, this ridiculous reaction shot of, like, Rita Wilson or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, like, you feel like you're on mushrooms or something when you're watching it, because, like, it doesn't make sense on any level. Like, how could this get made? How did someone write this? Like, no one write, I don't know. I mean, I guess it makes sense where there's, like, no one gave a shit. We just know that this movie, we can just put whatever on the screen and it's going to make money because it's got these people in it and it's a Christmas movie. But yeah. Good Lord.
Yeah, I think that movie, like, the production design, I just remember being horrifyingly bad. Like, I think there was, like, four total scenes, and they were, like, reused over and over. There was, like, the house where Schwarzenegger isn't there most of the time, and whoever the kind of smarmy, creepy neighbor is, like, always hitting on the wife and stuff. And then you've got, like, the department store, which is just reused and reused over and over and over again with these terrible, like, colored boxes everywhere. And then there's, like, this massive parade scene where they just, you know, film a bunch of stuff with Sinbad running through and essentially getting hit with a pie in the face. Like, that's, you know, they might as well be playing Yakety Sax in the background because it's just so ridiculous.
And you can never tell how surreal it's supposed to be because it'll be, like, super mundane street scene, and then the next minute, like, Arnold's flying to space, like, on a rocket. Like, what is going on?
Yeah, and he plays, like, he essentially turns
the moon.
He turns into Turbo Man at the end, like, becomes a superhero and is, like, literally flying around with a jetpack.
That scene was awesome. Don't mock it.
I mean, I guess that you could say The Jingle All the Way is one of the first superhero movies.
The kid finally gets his Turbo Man.
Yeah, but that's
the whole point of the story.
That's why something like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is so awesome, because it kind of directly references the kind of things that Jingle All the Way does terribly, where there's that storyline, that kind of subplot in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where one of the characters who's dressed up as this toy essentially just gets drunk and, like, stumbles into Michelle Monaghan's house. Like, I don't know if you guys have seen that movie or not, but
I have. It's been a while though.
Yeah, it's just, like, kind of a really minor thing, but it, you know, it kind of directly plays on that whole dressing up as the toy character and trying to save Christmas aspect. But
Vince, do you watch The League?
I do, yeah.
Mr. Giblets, the toy that they always dress up as.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, check that one out. It's pretty hilarious stuff.
Yeah, I still haven't.
Taco dresses up as like Mr. Giblets. He's like this green monster, and like the theme song to this cartoon is like "Rub My Belly." So Taco just goes around to all these different kids and like has them rub his belly. Like cops are chasing after him. It's pretty hilarious.
I still need to check out The League. I've only seen the pilot episode, and that's it, because I can't really find it online anywhere. I just need to rent the seasons or something. But
it started out really strong this year, and then, like, the last few have been pretty bad. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, Vinegar Strokes was pretty weak.
Yeah.
All right, well, like, I guess that'll pretty much wrap up our discussion about Good Will Hunting. Tyler, do you want to go ahead and kick on the Apple II and see what we're going to be watching next week?
Yeah, sure, no problem. Let me pull the comically large lever here.
All right.
All right, we're watching Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Chinese film, I think.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
Excellent.
Never seen it. Vince, you want to join us?
Not really, no.
Okay, good.
Nice. I love the honesty.
I fucking hate Wire Fu so much.
We'll get a chance to check this out. It's I haven't seen it either. It's from 2000. Ang Lee directed it, and I'm not sure if it's available on Netflix Watch Instant or not, but, you know, check it out. If you guys are interested in watching Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, letting us know what you think, you can email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com or call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566. This is normally the part of the show where we talk about our, you know, kind of listener emails and voicemails and stuff, and we actually don't have any this show. We're still a relatively young podcast, so we're still getting listeners and all that. So let's go ahead and move on and kind of finish up the character name game. So this is one, Vince, you missed the very beginning of the show, but this is a game where we list a character's name and then the other people on the panel have to guess what movie that character is from. So see if you can figure this one out. The character's name was Johnny Tyler. And the I know it gets really ridiculous because there's thousands of movies out there, but the kind of whatever saving grace is that there has to be the character has to be loosely related to somebody or something that came out in theaters this past weekend. So there's some sort of connection there. And see if you guys have any guesses about Johnny Tyler.
Go ahead, Vince.
My first inclination is Starship Troopers, but I don't think his name's Johnny Tyler. I think it was Johnny, what the hell, something else, Johnny something else, but I know that's not it.
It is not Starship Troopers. Tyler, any guesses?
Is it The Passenger?
It is not The Passenger. I'll see if I can give you guys a hint here. Let me see. The movie in question is from 1993. That might narrow it down some. And I'll give you another big hint. It's a Western. So, Johnny Tyler.
Oh, it's got to be – is that a Young Guns reference?
No, very close, though. Very close.
Is it Young Guns 2?
No, not that close. Sorry.
Is it Unforgiven?
No, but that's, you know, you're kind of getting more in the right tone of the Western as opposed to Young Guns. But Johnny Tyler, yeah, Western. There's a lot of really famous people in this Western. Let's see. I'm trying to think of any. Sam Elliott is in it.
Was it The Quick and the Dead?
It is not The Quick and the Dead.
I like how you went for that one. That one's awesome. It's Tombstone, right?
It is Tombstone. Yes. Oh, yeah. Very well done.
That was earlier than 93 for some reason.
Johnny Tyler was the character that Billy Bob Thornton played in Tombstone. He was the kind of faro dealer who got slapped around by Kurt Russell at one point.
And fat Billy Bob.
The connection, of course, being that Billy Bob Thornton plays the person known simply as Cop in the movie called Faster with Dwayne The Rock Johnson that came out this week. So
I would love to apply the naming conventions of Faster to Love and Other Drugs. So like Jake Gyllenhaal is just like boner pill salesman, and Anne Hathaway is like Parkinson's chick, and he's got like, oh, this is my friend Fat Pal.
That is actually pretty phenomenal. I and the thing about Faster too, I don't know if you've seen it, Vince, but they actually do like the freeze frame where the word comes up like it's some sort of Tarantino ripoff. Like,
Cop.
It's so bad.
Was it bad?
The movie was horrifyingly bad. It was terrible.
Well, that was the guy who did the Biggie movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I kinda liked that one. I thought it was gonna be horrible, but it's kinda like guilty pleasure good in a weird way.
I didn't get a chance. You're talking about Notorious, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not get a chance to see that.
It's actually kind of good.
Is it at all like an action movie? Like any type of action movie?
There's action in it.
Dead people?
There's action in it, but it's so just ripped from 30 other movies and pieced together terribly. There's like almost no style to it, and every plot device is just terrible. Like, you know, you understand with a movie like that that you're not going to get the best plot. Like, you know what you're getting when you walk in, but just the
race to which mountain.
The overall lack of respect for the audience is just like insulting, I think. So it's not even enjoyable on like a stylistic level. So I would just say stay far, far away from Faster.
Sorry, totally had a brain fart there. Is it like shaky cam? I mean, is it bad from a
There's a little bit of that. It does have, I don't know, there's not a lot of like up close fight scenes, you know, where people are just getting hit in the chest and stuff. It's a lot of gunplay, which is fine, but it just, oh man, I can't even, I don't know. Actually, I would kind of be interested to hear what you think about Advance. So maybe it would be worth your time just to either rip it apart or to defend it or something. But
I feel like those B action movies used to be so much better before like shaky cam and CGI blood and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I've been watching a lot of interviews and stuff with Billy Bob Thornton and Dwayne Johnson, and they all talk about like how proud they are of the movie and stuff. And I'm just like, man, like, you know, you can see just how much the marketing machine is really behind all these answers and stuff that they're giving, because you can't really look at that and be as proud of it as they claim. You know, like Billy Bob Thornton has actually been in good movies, and he, you know, is talking about this as like a you know, one of the better scripts that he's come across, and all, and you're just like, no, you're lying, just straight up, you're lying.
Your name's Cop.
Yeah.
Vince, have you seen any good movies lately?
I've been doing the Netflix instant documentaries a lot lately. So I was sort of catching up on a lot of the good stuff that I missed. Like, I finally saw King of Kong this past week, which is mm-hmm. really awesome.
Yeah.
I watched the Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia, which was pretty interesting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I saw Black Swan last week.
Oh, cool. Yeah, we were mentioning that early on. I have not got a chance to see it yet. I think I'll be able to see it on Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. But what did you think about it, just kind of without spoiling anything?
It's fucking bizarre. I mean, it's...
Yes.
It's amazing. Like, I could probably sum it up in 6 words, but... like the process you go through to realize that is kind of amazing. You're like, wow, that was it. Wow.
Okay.
It's yeah.
All right.
It's
so,
like, if you took Fame and made like, was Fame a show or was it always like a movie?
I think it was a Broadway thing, wasn't it?
I don't know. All I know is like the most screwed up version of Fame possible.
All right. Well, I have no idea whether that means that I should raise or lower my expectations, so I'm going to keep them exactly where they were before.
Dude, it's Aronofsky, man. You gotta keep them high.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. So, like I was saying, we have no listener email or anything, but we do have a couple new followers to our Twitter, which we just started. Hence the reason that we're naming our Twitter followers right now. So once you know this maybe potentially blows up, we're gonna stop doing this. But in the meantime, if you follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/njnmpodcast, then we'll read your name in the air. So we got @ebetcher. So thanks for the follow. And Kathy_nice. So good stuff there. Yeah.
Kathy Nice is definitely spam. I went to her. Calling you out right now. And she speaks Spanish. Everything's in Spanish on hers.
That doesn't mean that it's spam. You could just be like offending with what few listeners.
No, I translated the info.
Oh, wow. I like that.
Translate, man.
You go through all the detective work to find out our Twitter followers. That's pretty great.
Like the Eye of Sauron, I miss nothing.
All right, well, let's go around the circle and just tell everybody where they can find more of our work on the internet. Vince Mancini, where can people track you down this week?
Come check me out at filmdrunk.com. Also, I do a segment for The Grid on IFCTV. That's IFCTV/The Grid. Twitter/FilmDrunk.
And the Frotcast, correct?
That's correct, yeah. You can check out the Film Drunk Frotcast, F-R-O-T, Frotcast. Yeah, that's on iTunes.
Nice.
Frotcast Vince is a slice of brilliant, man. I listen to that stuff every week. It cracks me up.
Thank you.
Congrats on appearing on IFC. That's pretty big time.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell they were thinking, but I'm okay with it.
Nice. I hope you keep posting those clips on Film Drunk just so people can kind of mercilessly continue to make fun of you.
Yeah, that's the best part of my job.
Right on. Well, Tyler Brands, where can people track you down on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can find me on The Solar Sentinel, Destigan, and GeekTyrant.com, as usual.
Nice. You guys can...
over there, Vince.
What's that?
He's like loading ammo over there.
Oh, sorry. I moved my laptop off of my lap onto the table, so probably... Yeah.
Well, you guys can
step on your plugs.
Yeah, say them again, Tyler, just in case. But
yeah, Solar Sentinel, Destigeddon, and GeekTyrant.com.
Nice. You can track me down on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears, writing sporadically at GeekTyrant.com, reviews at Filmonic.com, and NotJustNewMovies.com, the namesake of this podcast. Pat and I are normally found on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast. And that's about it. So music for our show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at gtbandits.com. They are also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out over there. Vince Mancini, special thanks for stopping by and donating some of your time to the show. Thanks for coming back.
Always a pleasure.
Awesome. And Tyler, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, thanks for listening, and come back next week and listen to us talk about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And have a good week, everybody. We'll talk to you later.
I got the blues, yeah. all the money that I had.